Welcome to the weekly. I'm Jeremy.
I'm Matt.
Hey, Matt. So Chris is not here this week. The company has some COVID positive tests. So Chris is out for, not with a positive test, but is filling in for all the missing employees. So unfortunately, no lunch, no nothing. So Matt was kind enough to jump in a box and and be beside me for this
swim
week.
For Japan.
Nice. So this is the 209th episode. So this week on the weekly, Dungeon Scrawl on Roll 20, Warzone Eternal releases its beta rules, Final Fantasy 14 gets a TTRPG. And continuing our battle with AI, authors now are suing OpenAI directly. All right. So let's start with the... this was something... We talked about this a few years back when it was first out in beta. So Dungeon Scrawl is a web-based mapping application. I think there's a lot of other things like Incarnate and I think Dungeon Alchemy that are doing things differently and in some ways better than what they're able to do. And I had a kind of bad experience with their beta because I tried to use it in an actual session, so in a Discord-based roleplay session. So I was mapping the whole adventure and it just crashed. And because it was web-based, I didn't make a file. There was no save function. And so when the page reloaded, it was blank. So everything got erased. So hopefully they figured out, you know, hopefully you're writing local save files or you're doing something with the newer versions, with like the full release version that makes Dungeon Scrawl less fragile, because that's not a good thing to have. But what they're doing now is that they're going to implement that application into Roll 20. So they'll have a real-time integration for online map making using the Dungeon Scrawl application, the technology. So they announced plans. So Roll 20 announced plans to implement. They didn't give really a timetable, and they were just kind of talking, these would be nice features to have. We might do this, we might do that, but nothing is set in stone. So on their official blog, they said they will allow both game masters and players to have access to these tools. So players can map during the session and game masters can create maps either on the fly or, ahead of time for their adventures. So, yeah, this article called Dungeon Scrawl the leader in online map making services, which I don't know if that's necessarily true, but they have some nice features. So what you can do is when you're drawing the maps out, you can switch to an isometric mode. So regardless of how you're building the map, you have like two versions of the map that you're creating at the same time. And they also have a lot of interesting effects, like the little old school like hatch marks on the outside to show, you know, where the solid, you know, rock is and the earth that you're digging into. There's a lot of things that make it look very old school and are very charming about the presentation. And then of course they also let you do either hexes or squares. And the aerial view, like overhead view and isometric switch is pretty cool. That's a pretty nice, because it also is a nice way to, you know, kind of revisualize things for players. So there was a comment. So the blog writer was Andrew Sayles from Roll 20, who's the project manager. And what they want to do with this integration of Dungeon Scrawl is create easier methods to export maps, and then a shared library of user-made maps, and then also some other unrevealed, you know, plans. But they don't know if any of this is actually going to happen. So the thing that they are doing is implementing it as is, and they've on the blog post that says there's no strict timeline for when this is coming out. But there will be Dungeon Scrawl implementation. So what do you think, Matt? Do you think that's useful? Do you think that would be useful?
Well, like you said, if it's stable.
Mm-hmm.
when you did it, you were playing over Discord,
mm-hmm.
but you were live mapping, so there was some way for everyone to join your your map, basically?
No, I was just mapping. I was going to export it like as we finish, and no one could see what I was doing. I was just kind of testing the app and seeing if on the fly it worked very well. And the early version of it had no furniture assets or anything. So basically, I was just doing circles and squares to represent things, and figured I could go back in Photoshop and whatever, and you know, sweeten up the look of some of the assets. But yeah, no, it was basically just using, instead of pen and paper, you know, like instead of graph paper and a pen, I was using this tool in another window, and it had a little hiccup mid session, and I was like, okay, it's all gone.
Yeah, I mean, it's cool. I think we're going to see a lot of this, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of the big VTT players scrambling for unique, like, services or products that they can sell.
Yes.
Because they're, you know, obviously they're all, probably all worried about the whole D&D Beyond, whatever it's called.
Yes, thing. Yes.
And yeah, so we're probably going to see a lot of that. I don't know about the tools. I've never used it. Mm-hmm. I've used Dungeon Craft, which is very useful. It's not the prettiest. And I've used Incarnate, which is beautiful.
Yeah, yeah.
But they don't really, I feel, I've had Incarnate. I've been a paying user of Incarnate for, gosh, probably 3 years now. Mm-hmm. And their implementation of new stuff is super slow.
Yeah. Like
they don't really roll out new stuff much. Mm-hmm. They've been talking about doing like a modern or sci-fi set of tools for a long time. And it still hasn't really happened.
Well, yeah.
You know, so, but overall, you can make beautiful maps on there. So we'll probably see something like that with Incarnate in some VTT at some point or something. I don't know. But I would expect, all the big VTT players to be looking for things that are like, look at us, we're different. Mm-hmm. We've got this. You know.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. Everyone's going to be kind of bracing themselves for whatever's going to happen to the player base with Wizards' release of this, whatever this is. Yeah, we talked a little bit about that before the podcast. There are early reports now of what that's looking like, cuz people are doing like alpha. They're allowed to try it online. And it sounds mixed. Yeah. The reviews so far are mixed, and people, we'll just have to get used to it. And it'll be interesting, because then there'll be a whole generation of players that's the way to play. You know, that's all they've ever done. That's the way they've played Dungeons and Dragons. So weird stuff. But speaking of trying betas, there is a beta set of rules that came out for the Warzone Eternal Kickstarter. So ResNova released the beta rules, and so posted on the Kickstarter page for all the backers. So they're saying, while this is a beta release, the document reflects a massive amount of effort from our development and playtest teams. So barring a final editing pass and potential reorganization of content to respond to usability considerations, this will be the final pre-release state of the rules. So they included a few things, a few unit types, the Nephrite of Algaroth and the Cartel Field Agent that don't have stats for them. So these are going to be things that are going to maybe roll out in the future. They haven't completely playtested them yet, but they did include them in this, but otherwise you're getting a pretty complete force list of everything that they produced for this original kind of core set. There isn't a scenario builder, so they give you you can roll a d20, and I think there's like four or five scenarios that are kind of the basic ones to play with this original release of the rules, but they don't give you the ability to build them yet. And of course, these beta rules start with chapter 2, because they don't give you any of the fluff either. Like I think chapter 1 is going to be the setting and everything. So ResNova said that they're open to answering questions either on the Facebook group or wherever you can get a hold of them. I'm sure the comment section of Kickstarter as well. And the last thing they said is, I'm fairly confident that we've otherwise created a comprehensive and understandable set of rules. So they're looking forward to pictures of your games as you're playtesting for them. So this is a little interesting because talking to ResNova, especially before their first canceled Kickstarter, they were very conservative about how they were going to release things and very protective of, so no STLs of the miniatures. They didn't want to have, you know, a PDF of the rules floating around out there. But they weren't going to do a nice hardcore rule book. They're still doing this, like, you know, kind of half size, like A5 size little soft cover book. But I'm surprised that this is out there now, if it is a fairly, you know, complete set of the rules, because this is what people have been waiting for ever since this was announced, is the ability to play an updated version of Warzone. So yeah, we'll see how people respond to this. And the one thing I was concerned with, because I kind of skimmed them, basically the PDF, it was pretty complete and pretty easy to navigate. I skimmed what they had so far, and they touch on the light and dark mechanic. So if you're not playing Brotherhood or the Dark Forces, or you're not playing Algaroth or any of the Dark Symmetry forces, you could choose to have some kind of consultant, advisor. I think they call them advisors. So for the Brotherhood, they call them advisors, and I think they're just called cultists for the Dark Legion forces. You can include them in your armies, and I think they're doing that. I thought that was going to be a huge mechanic in the game, but it just seems to be like a smaller thing that you can do. So you have these corporate, you have the five corporations, and you can include either light or dark forces. And I'm not sure you can both choose. I think you have to choose opposing. I have to double check if that's, you know, how they set that up. But you can include and I think that because that gives you access to things that other armies can't do. So basically, you know, they have magic, or they have, you know, special abilities that the regular corporate forces don't have. And so that was their way to, like, give you, you know, casters, or give you something, give you undead or something in your army. Basically, but I was worried when I first heard them talking about that, I was worried that was going to be this huge thing that kind of themed the whole game, and didn't seem quite to make sense in the world if you're always choosing opposing forces. But it seems like that's a minor thing, so maybe that got scaled down between rule versions. The other thing I noticed in the rules is there's no panic rules. They're using the bolt action style pinning rules, so pin counters on depending on how much damage is done. So there's no panic. You're not making the rolls for leadership or anything. You're just unpinning yourself when you take too much damage. So yeah, I'm curious what the kind of community reaction will be now that we have the full rules and the stat lines and everything, because that was a surprising thing that they released the stats for the units in the book. I mean, you can't play test otherwise, but I thought the intention was those were only going to appear on cards that were only packaged with the miniatures. So they would protect themselves from, you know, anybody having a full rule set. This is a full rule set. So that was a little bit surprising. Yeah.
They probably realized that that's pointless. That stuff's going to get out no matter what.
Right.
So is the core, like, combat resolution system pretty much the same as older versions of the game?
Yeah, it's very, very similar in it's D20 based. You're rolling under, you know, kind of coming up with a target number, and then you have an armor save. They don't call it an armor save, but you have an armor roll, I guess. So yeah, it's very similar to first edition. Yeah, because I was comparing it. Yeah, I had my first edition copy, so I was like comparing it directly. So they have almost, the stat lines are almost identical. They don't have actions, I don't think. Which is the only difference. So some units can take, you know, more actions during a turn, or more can, you know, be activated more. The one thing that I wasn't, which I think is similar to first edition, that I think has changed, and especially in skirmish is much more fun, is alternating activations. So you played Stargrave, right? So you alternate, you know, you move a unit, the other person moves a unit. And that has, you know, you can react and have things that much more can be going on because the turn changes so quickly. So this has an active player and a reactive player in, two parts, you know, each part of the turn. So you're an active player once per turn and a reactive player once per turn. And if your units aren't pinned, then they can have a reaction token, which means they can do something. So if they're hit in melee, they can hit back. You know, if they're shot at, they can dodge. There's a lot of actions that you can take as reactions. And so that's how they're trying to handle not being alternating activation, is giving you some things you can do on your turn, you know, when it's not your turn, essentially, when it's your reaction turn, when you're, you know, defensive. So I don't know. I kind of like most of the modern games, you know, that I played are like, you know, move a unit, I move a unit. And that's nice. But I guess that maybe the old school flavor is what they were going for. But then they, you know, kind of seasoned it with a little bit of that reaction. So a little bit more like Infinity. When someone is shooting at you, you do something about it. You don't just stand there and let your armor take it, or, you know, whatever. So it has a little bit, it's kind of, a combination of those things. And deployment was the same way. Unless there's a special rule that lets you set up out of deployment. Basically, one person sets up everything, the other person sets up everything, and you're rolling for, just rolling off initiative to decide who does that first, who deploys first. And then the person that doesn't deploy gets the first turn, the first action, the first active player. The one thing that I didn't like about initiative, which I'm not sure, I don't know, this seems like an odd thing, but there's some bonuses, like leadership and things give you a bonus to your initiative. So you roll a d20 and then you add, you know, +5 or whatever your bonus is. But you also add whatever victory points you've already achieved in previous turns. So that means that the winner, the person that's already winning, is more likely to go first again. Yeah. And that tends to snowball. You know, that tends to, so you're going to definitely want strategies to very early on take whatever objectives you can just for that additional initiative boost, because that's going to help you. I mean, because a lot of the games, you know, Chris and I were playing with Oathmark. It really did come down to whoever got initiative on that last turn was going to win because, you know, there was things would get that close sometimes. So if you have this like building initiative bonus just based on victory points, I don't know if that's a great way.
No, that's what in board gaming we would call a win more mechanic.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I despise those. I feel like if you've built a win more mechanic into your game, you've failed already.
Yes. So we'll see. They sound pretty confident about these rules. So we'll see what's going on. I'm curious how people will react, because they have the flavor of first edition Warzone. You know, with a little bit of the reactive tokens are a more recent update. And the stat lines are interesting. They've kind of rebalanced some of the weapons and things to work a little differently. And the other thing is, just like the old school games, you have all of those, special, everything has like a keyword or a property that, you know, gives it special effects. So there's a lot of those to learn. For each type of weapon and things. So that'll give some different flavor to the different corporation, you know, troops, because they'll have weapons that, you know, have area effect or have some armor piercing or something. So we'll see.
I really liked how Stargrave was kind of a blend, like, because you had alternating phases or alternating turns, but it was in phases. So you'd alternate the captains and they could command up to three of your dudes, then you'd alternate the first mates and they could command up to three guys.
Mm-hmm.
And then anybody you had left over would go in the last phase. So it was alternating, but it was in phases.
Mm-hmm.
And then what I really liked was, if you got into melee combat, you didn't have reactions,
mm-hmm.
but if you went into melee combat, there was one combined roll between the two opponents, and that roll could go either way.
Oh, so yeah,
the defender could end up doing the damage instead of the attacker.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I really liked that you had that weird, it made melee feel significant and different, mm-hmm. from just shooting.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's good. And I like that they stuck with the D20. I think D20 is really swingy in war games. So it allows you to be like, oh, I can't believe, like, I had a huge advantage. I was going to crush you, and you pulled that off. You know, you totally defended that or whatever. Yeah, so the swinginess of D20 is kind of fun in war game, skirmish war games, because it doesn't feel so predestined. Yeah.
Just, so you got to prepare new players, because some people get really butthurt by the swinginess.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's 20. Right. That's true. Yeah, because we had some of that come up with Stargrave. Yeah, people like, you know, throwing dice across off the table and be like, I'm not using that one anymore. That one must be cursed. Yeah. Yeah. Because you can get some, and that was the thing too, you know, significantly failing in Frostgrave or Stargrave had that consequence too, where you took damage to yourself. You know, one of their magic rolls. Yeah. You hurt yourself really, really failing your magic rolls. All right. Well, it's an anniversary. Everything's having an anniversary. So next year we got, what, the 50th anniversary of D&D, but this year we can celebrate the 10th anniversary of Final Fantasy XIV. So and coming to the tabletop. So Final Fantasy XIV was kind of this attempted sequel. It's an MMO that they had Final Fantasy XI, and these are weird because these are the, you know, Japanese RPGs that are sequentially numbered that have been going on since the early 90s. And when they got to 11, they said, hey, let's make an MMO. And they made a really difficult, very old school MMO. And that was 11. And then by the time they get to 14, let's do it again, because, you know, the technology had improved. And, the first attempt was a miserable failure. Technically, it didn't work very well. There was no kind of end game content, so people kind of blew through the game. And we're like, now what do we do? And they're like, well, we haven't built that yet. So it was a really big, really big failure in its first year of release. So they actually took it down. And then they spent, I think it was 2 years, and then they released A Realm Reborn. And that was this like relaunch of this game. So basically they, you know, they had all these assets that they built for this game, but just how, you know, the battle worked, how some of the skill systems worked and stuff, people weren't happy with. So they relaunched it, didn't have to do any of the, you know, the heavy lifting work, just some kind of programming. And now it is probably the number one MMO out there. I think it's as World of Warcraft kind of fades, you hear more people talking about Final Fantasy XIV really than anything else. You know, they occasionally like a Korean game will pop up into popularity, but for some reason they hit this like sweet spot of people that like Final Fantasy, people that like Japanese, you know, style RPGs. And it really, really did well in that relaunch, which is, I don't think anyone's ever done that before. If you try to relaunch it, there's just no chance. But for their 10th anniversary, they've announced a tabletop starter set for the RPG, in which you can recreate your characters from the MMO in a pen and paper game. So this set is going to include a player's book, a game master's book, pre-made character sheets for warrior, white mage, dragoon, black mage jobs already, and then of course the rules to build those, as well as a custom set of 16 dice, 6 d20s and 10 d6s. So it'll be a d20 d6 system. And the interesting thing about the job system and how the MMO itself works is your class choices are fluid just based on your equipment. So if you change what you're wearing, you change your gear, you change your class or your job, essentially. And I think that's something that they took from the original Sword World. The Japanese Sword World RPG has that same sort of idea, where you can level different jobs or different classes just based on what you're using to attack or what you're using to cast with. So an interesting system, and I think that would be fun to play on the tabletop. So this is, we don't know how much they're actually going to support this. This may just be like an anniversary treat kind of celebration thing. This 10th year now concludes the first story arc is now concluding after 10 years. So they've been releasing, additional content for 10 years to this MMO, which is pretty crazy to have to still maintain popularity, because usually they blow it in some, to some extent. But on the website, it says, newcomers will be well equipped with this starter set, which includes scenarios supervised by the Final Fantasy XIV development team and original custom dice, all carefully crafted to provide an engaging experience for all fans of Final Fantasy XIV and tabletop RPGs. So you can pre-order it now. It's retailing for $60, $59.99 US. And yeah, so you can, the release is not until, so actually maybe next year is the 10th anniversary. The release is not until, I believe, I'm just looking at that. I was just looking at that date now. Where is it? May. Yeah, May of next year is the actual release. So you can pre-order now on the website. And it may, depending on if the pre-order is going to be how many they make, or if they have a, they could sell out, because I can't imagine they're going to make these forever. But there's some photos on the website, and they look like they're doing a nice job. It, you know, it's themed like the game. And it's, because it's Japanese, it's a very small form factor. The box itself is very tiny. All the books are booklets, you know, essentially. So it's like a tiny, you know, a smaller scale kind of game, and there's tokens and things to support all the mechanics you need. But yeah, so you can return to, I forget how to pronounce the world name, Erzia? Erzia? Erzia, maybe Erzia. They spell things horribly in Final Fantasy. But yeah, but that is available for pre-order on their site. And along with that, so if that's not enough for you, if you need to celebrate Final Fantasy XIV even more, just like we talked about with these Beetle and Grimm guys doing their custom whiskeys, a Japanese company, Nagahama Roman Beer Company, is producing three Final Fantasy XIV whiskeys. Nah. So each of them are themed after the game's starting cities. So when you make a character, you can choose one of three cities to start in, and they're kind of, you know, geographically kind of on the other, each other side of the continent from each other, and they have a different look and feel. Like one's a desert, one's a forest, and one's a seaside kind of pirate themed city. And so they so this company has announced they're doing this as another anniversary celebration. So the three whiskeys. The first one is the Ulda, representing the desert metropolis, which will be aged in wine and sherry barrels for a complex and luxurious flavor. The Gridania is the dense, sprawling forest city, will be an unblended whiskey to accent woody, leafy, and smoky notes. And then the Lominsa is the sea-based, the port town, which will have a sea breeze with sweet, mellow finish, a grain whiskey. The other two are malt. This would be a grain whiskey. And to further incorporate the pirate theming of the port city, they will be aged in rum barrels. So if you thought the tabletop RPG was expensive, that starter set, these will be 8,000 yen each for 700 milliliters. So not even a liter, 700 milliliters of whiskey. So about $65 maybe US, and will be available available October 10th. The images they show, they have very, you know, gorgeous painted labels, you know, to theme with the cities. But yeah, these are definitely collector's items. I don't know if you want to open these bottles anytime soon, but they're going to be available as a celebration. So the Isetan department store is going to have a Final Fantasy kind of collaboration. So a decade's journey, they're calling it. And so they'll feature these whiskeys as one of the, you know, the limited goods you can buy at this department store in Tokyo. And also the website, they'll be available to order starting September 28th. And the celebration at the department store goes from September 28th to October 2nd. So basically just a long weekend. It's a very, very short celebration. But yeah, so Final Fantasy is a serious thing here. They're not messing around.
So this is the same issue I had with the last whiskey we discussed. If it's coming out in September, mm-hmm. when did this whole plan get greenlit? Because if you're going to age it right, you didn't do this like 2 months ago.
Yeah. Well, I think the blended ones they could get away with. Yeah. The two blended whiskeys they can get away. It may just be like, you know, basically relabeling a product they were already they already had in barrels. Yeah. I don't really.
I've had a really good Japanese whiskey.
Oh, like, yeah, yeah.
Like when Japan decides they like a thing and they're going to excel at it, they kill it.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like, damn it. This sounds like it's going to not be that way.
Right, right. Yeah, the yeah, this seems like a novelty thing because sometimes they'll do like health potions and things. So they make it like an energy drink that's a health potion. They'll put it in a fancy bottle and label it Final Fantasy, you know, for the collectors. But yeah, Japan doesn't mess around. A Japanese guy married a Scottish woman, brought her to Japan and said, "Teach me how to make whiskey." And basically the Nika Whiskey Company was born. Yeah, one of the bigger whiskey manufacturers. So if you marry into it, I guess it's okay. But yeah, my daughter in the US, they're going to be visiting Japan, and she said to visit the Final Fantasy Cafe, they had to make a reservation a month ahead of time. So she was trying to schedule that during their visit, but she had to do it 30 days ahead because a Final Fantasy Cafe, which is basically just a cafe with coffee and desserts that look like Final Fantasy characters, with a little gift shop, like with a little exclusive gift shop you can exit through, and that's basically all it is. And you got to make reservations just for the privilege of buying a, you know, $12 latte. Yeah.
So getting back to the actual TTRPG
part of this,
Do you think they're going to support it, or is this just a special thing and they're going to walk away from
it? I don't know. Yeah, it makes me worried that it's a you know, that it's an anniversary. They're theming it for the 10th anniversary. It would be cool if they supported it because it's a fun system, and the art style, especially if they use the art style from their printed work from the game, the illustrations are really wonderful, and the whole world is very fun and very charming. So if they did support it and gave you, like, you know, adventures in the starting cities and everything, it could be really fun because there's so much content already written. You know, there's characters, and you know, you have all your NPCs, you have descriptions of them and everything from the MMO. So you could and you know, all of the character art and everything already exists. So I doubt it. I don't know. I it depends. If it's insanely popular, which it will be for just for the collector's sake, but maybe if gamers pick this up as well, it could be something that they support in some kind of way. It may be. It is Square Enix, and they're not great at being like receptive to fans and stuff. They have their own ideas of how to do things, which get a little frustrating. I think for people sometimes, but I don't know. And if they're producing this themselves, if they're not using a third party to kind of put this together, I don't know. We may see. I would imagine if it does get supported, maybe only digitally. You know, there maybe it's like some PDFs or something that come out in the future.
So, is it the Sword World people involved,
or is it just using the system? It seems like the system. Yeah, it's well, the MMO itself seems like it was inspired by that system. So I would guess that this would feel very Sword World. So that would be weird if they don't use that system. It would be very strange because it'd be like this, like, weird, you know, lost in translation version of, you know, going back to that system through an MMO. So yeah, they didn't say specifically anything about the mechanics.
Okay. Because I listened to a podcast not too long ago where the theme of the podcast was RPGs where you get to play goblins. Mm-hmm. And there were some cool ones, but they brought up the Goblin Slayer RPG, which is, I guess, based on the Sword World game. And it sounds like they just put out a book and then never came back to that one.
Right. Yeah, I wonder, and I'm not sure the mentality here if Japanese players are very much into making their own original adventures. I've never been in like a Japanese language, you know, gaming group, so I don't know how they play, and if they want to follow some pre-written thing, you know, if they want a campaign and adventure made by the company, or if they just want to do their own thing. So I'm not sure. This might be a good starting point for doing that. And, you know, like I said, there's just so much content out there. You could endlessly, you could get 10 years of the MMO content that you could bring into this game. So, yeah, could be pretty, pretty fun. But, yeah, I thought that was really funny that it's been around for so long. And now they're finally putting it on the tabletop. But it's weird. Yeah, they're kind of randomly making tabletop RPGs based on popular things here recently. I think because, you know, they've noticed the popularity of 5e and some of the hobby shops, their RPG sections are getting quite large. There's a lot of indie RPGs and stuff here.
Did somebody, am I remembering this wrong? Did somebody make a Warcraft TTRPG? And it like bombed?
I can't remember. There've been board games. There was like a Chinese like knockoff board game of Warcraft. But I don't think there's been there's been trading card games. I've had like card battler, collectible card games, but I don't think they've done a tabletop RPG for Warcraft. Yeah. I don't think so. Not anything that got any traction.
Surprised.
Yeah, me too. That seems like an obvious. And maybe if the timing was different, and also maybe they were just worried because, you know, that's the funny thing about this is an MMO is such a time suck. And why would you play a tabletop pen and paper RPG when you could just be logged into your character and leveling your character, you know? So it's kind of like a weird, there's a weird kind of conflict between these two systems. And like, oh yeah, I want to play my character from the MMO, you know, at the table. Okay, actually, no, I don't want to do this anymore. I want to get back to my character, you know, because the amount of hours you have to put into these games is crazy. So anything that you take, that used to take away. So yeah, like I'm saying that may have been their thought. So Blizzard may have said, oh yeah, that would be really cool. And we have a lot of great art assets to do this, but that would mean that they are not logged in to playing World of Warcraft. So let's not, they're participating with the IP, but they're not, you know, using their subscription. So who knows? Who knows what the thinking was? All right. And we got to come up with a name for this segment because I think it's going to keep occurring. But the war with AI or the the fight with the machines. So another story. So last week we talked about some artists that sounded like, you know, they didn't have a lot of money. They're actually having trouble paying their rent and were trying to sue Midjourney and some of the art creation software. And also, I think DeviantArt as well was named to try to, you know, say that they've stolen their you know, copyrighted work without their consent and to get some sort of relief for that. That doesn't sound like it's going to go particularly well. But we have some big names now. This has been going on. There's been a couple of previous cases, but we have some big names now that are going directly after OpenAI for copyright infringement. So previously, I think there was a privacy. They tried to go after these AI scraping, scrapers for privacy violations. That got dismissed. But now they're doing a class action lawsuit and one of the big names is, of course, George R.R. Martin is one of the people named in this OpenAI lawsuit. So 17 well-known authors, including Jonathan Frazin, John Grisham, George R.R. Martin, Jody Picoult, and others are going to be suing in the Southern District Court of New York as plaintiffs in a class action suit. So the complaint says OpenAI has copied the plaintiff's work wholesale without permission or consideration and fed that, you know, copyrighted material into their language model, the large language models for ChatGPT. So the complaint also says these authors' livelihoods are derived from these works that they create, but the defenders' LLMs endanger the fiction writer's ability to make a living in that the LLMs, the large language models, allow anyone to generate automatically and freely or very cheaply text that they would otherwise pay creators to create. So they're saying these derivative works that are based on mimic, summarize, or paraphrase their books and harm that market. So, they're going on to say, of course, you know, they could have trained this AI on works in the public domain, but instead they chose to feed it ebooks. Previously, I think earlier in September, John Grisham, Michael Chabon, and some others were putting together this. That's right. So the latest lawsuit was put together earlier this month. But previously in June, we had comedian Sarah Silverman. I think we talked about this last week. Christopher Golden, Richard Codrey, and others suing OpenAI and Meta directly. They filed a complaint in June, saying that their writing and their work was taken to use to train their AI models. So this sounds like it has a little bit better of a chance of getting a response, but it's just going to be rewards for the lawyers running the class action lawsuit and some people that are already quite comfortably wealthy from their from their writing. But at least it may set a legal precedent that will protect smaller creators in the world. Unfortunately, though, companies, this isn't the first time that they've been threatened many times by this. And Microsoft has stepped up, who partners with OpenAI. They've stepped up to say, we will take the legal heat from all the commercial users if the Copilot AI service that they're developing with them gets sued. So Microsoft has very deep pockets, so I don't think you're gonna get anywhere suing anything. Microsoft is gonna back and hire their put their legal team toward. So we'll see. There's, like I said, there was a previous privacy violation lawsuit that was dismissed. And one of these is going to have to hopefully make some progress and set a precedent that then people can start to regulate or, as a basis to start to create some sort of law about how this stuff should work.
I get why the privacy one had no chance, mm-hmm. because anything you put online, you've already accepted some terms. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. To make that stuff public anyway, so you're screwed.
Yeah.
But the challenge with it, as far as copyright, and they're going to need to get a smart judge who cares.
Yeah, right.
I'm thinking of that old thing with the congressman a million years ago who was trying to describe the internet on the floor of the house, and he was like, it's a series of tubes,
right?
So you don't want a judge like that,
right?
You want one that you can show like evidence. Okay, this was our property, and here's what they produced, and it's clear that they derived it from this kind mm-hmm. of thing. they might have a chance. Mm-hmm. I kind of agree with what Chris said last week. Like, it's not really AI. We should stop. It should stop being called AI. Mm-hmm. It's really just like extremely powerful information gathering and sorting.
Right. Right.
That it gathers it and it sorts it based on parameters. Mm-hmm. It's not really AI. That's going to be a whole different problem. Like if they make like completely sentient AI, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. right? Because then it'll be like, okay, you can't say he just stole this stuff or it stole this stuff because he's doing it essentially the way a human would do it,
right? Like, right?
Drawing on life experiences or whatever.
Right. Yeah.
That'd be way trickier.
Yeah, definitely. If it was an AI that you could consider able to create, then it could hold a copyright, then why wouldn't that thing be able to have a copyright as well? Yeah. So it's just brutal that they've taken advantage of. So things moved from, you used to have to pay money for a website and like you're paying to set things up. And then as social media and things expanded and we had platforms like Facebook and YouTube, people could just start throwing stuff out there freely. And you didn't have to pay to host any of this stuff. So you could, do thousands of hours of video or whatever. And there's lots of platforms that would host them for free. Back in the kind of early days of the internet, it was pay to play. You had to set up a website to distribute anything. So, there was this barrier to entry, and now they've taken advantage of the fact that there's all these platforms that have made you sign some sort of user agreement to put stuff, completely out there, and they're just scraping it. They're just using it. Well, now we can train things on this, and I think that's a real mistake because they're going to force things back into you know, everything's going to have a paywall now. Everything to get into anything, you're going to have to start. We don't want you looking at this because they've signed an agreement and you have to agree to do something before you can come in, and we're going to get your credit card, you know, on the way in.
Yeah, you'll have to host your stuff in some special protected environment.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's kind of ironic on a not important note that George R.R. Martin is part of this lawsuit because I think a lot of Game of Thrones fans wish he would use AI and just finish his damn book, you know?
Yeah, that's what's going to happen is after he passes away, they're just going to feed his works into AI and just, yeah, press a button. Give us those two last books, you bastard. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, so, yeah. Miguel even said that. Yeah, this is just one more excuse for him not to finish. Yeah, exactly. But don't get involved in anything else. No more TV, no lawsuits, George. Just start writing. Yeah, it's too bad. Yeah, it's gonna be a shame when he like had the chance to finish this story, but because he got involved in that HBO series. And, you know, whatever reasons, I mean, maybe because of the reaction to his initial ideas for how these storylines were going to end, because that's basically what he did. He gave them like cliff notes or his like outlines of what the last two books were going to do. And they just, they just puked it out. And so maybe now he just won't go anywhere near it. So you're going to have this kind of Wheel of Time situation where it's like, well, are we going to hand this to another author to continue the story? Or are we going to just let it, you know, die mid-sentence, basically. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think after the third book, he got really up his own ass and it got really boring, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like, I don't even care if he finishes it.
Yeah, I wonder.
Those books turned into slogs after book three.
Mm-hmm, Yeah, and it sounds like they're just getting bigger and bigger. Like the page count is just, you know, getting insane. They're not going to be able to actually fit a physical paperback binding anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's crazy. But then they can release them in volumes like they love to do anyhow. Yeah. The part one and part two of the last book. Yeah. So, this is interesting. We'll keep an eye on this as... you know, different people at different levels. And and like we saw with, it was a Stronghold Games. Yeah, just kind of like, yeah, we're just using AI. What are you going to do about it? Yeah, it's the future. It's the inevitable future.
Yeah. And, oh man, I shared with you that article just as a kind of a follow-up to that story you did. It was like, I didn't know that Stronghold and Indie board games had merged.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, you have indie in your name.
Right.
What are you doing?
Yes. Yeah, that's too bad that they're really gonna like hurt, you know, so many people that could actually be producing, you know, be working with them doing art and rules writing and text, you know, doing the all of the support writing for games. And she's like, no, we'll just have AI do it because, and I guess though, that's the problem. The weird, because there are so many contractors, because there's so few in-house people doing things anymore. And it's so many contractors. I think there's a weird kind of suspicious, a relationship that has a little bit too much suspicion, in it that as soon as people that are just working as contractors that are working multiple jobs for multiple companies, as soon as they get tools that are going to cut time and make it easier for them to make money, that the contractors themselves may take advantage. Because that was the problem that Wizards had, is they had a contractor that was editing his illustrations with AI art apps. So I think there's a bit of suspicion. So the companies are just much more easy to give up because they're just going to assume that they're lazy, low paid artists and writers are going to try to do that to them anyhow, just to, get more work. I have a feeling that there's a weird, the way that digital art seems to go, you know, like with, when things like Fiverr and some of those gig job kind of websites came up, it was just, you know, find the cheapest possible way to flip assets or recycle tools or things that already existed online to make a quick buck. as a, you know, creative contractor. And now there's, you know, I think that that whole mentality has tainted, you know, how a lot of companies view their contractors or people they work with. So I don't know. Yeah, that's just my thought. So I think they're seeing that as a justification. It's like, yeah, we're gonna get screwed with AI, so we may as well stop caring and start using it ourselves. I don't know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But hopefully someday we'll have rules. We'll have rules and guidelines, best practices for how to use this stuff.
Hopefully. I mean, I think publishers, if they care about their content creators and like their credibility of their work they put out, mm-hmm. then maybe they'll actually actively oppose this. But I imagine there's always that greed factor where they're like, or we could just save a ton of money.
Yep.
Ditch all these legendary authors and, you know.
Right. And for a monthly subscription, we can generate as much text as we would ever need. Yeah.
Yeah,
it'll be weird. And like there was some art teacher that was doing a podcast that said, yeah, you're going to go to art school and you're going to learn how to write prompts. It's going to be a prompt writing studio instead of actually like holding a paintbrush or a pen. You're going to just be learning how to say that, use the best adjectives to feed the AI, the AI art generation. All right. Well, that is going to do it for this week. So where can people find you, Matt?
I am on Threads and Instagram. It's at Hargald, H-A-R-G-A-L-D, where I do talk a lot about games, but I also talk about some randomness and F1, sorry, which is in your neck of the woods this weekend, by the way.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, the Japanese Grand Prix is this weekend.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, up in Suzuka. And yeah, my drive-through books.
Mm-hmm. I have one
copper and one silver.
Nice.
And I won this one publication or one purchase away from being copper. So, you know, feel free to swing by drive-through and bump that up one.
Oh, nice. Yeah, we'll put a link to your drive-through, everything you've got on drive-through, so people can find that easily in the description. Yeah, very cool. Nice. I'm still doing, unfortunately, it didn't happen this week, but I'm still doing the single panel gag cartoon, abuse cartoons on YouTube and Twitch. So I draw the cartoons on a live stream and eat some Japanese snack food from the convenience store to kind of break up the drawing process. And so that's Abuse Cartoons. And if you want to read that cartoon, Go Comics has it. So gocomics.com/domesticabuse. And if you want to support what we're doing here on the weekly, visit upturntable.com. And there you'll find everything that we've been working on. It's UpturnTable on both YouTube and Twitch. And these live streams get archived on there. But if you'd like to listen to them on a RSS feed, you can become a patron. So consider becoming a weakling on Patreon. Patreon.com/UpturnTable. And I completely did not prepare for this. We have a new weakling. So the weakling ranks have grown. So thank you very much to Derek Semsik. Derek Semsik is our newest weakling. So thank you so much for supporting us. Yes, I should have had some fireworks and confetti with your name. So sorry about that. I completely forgot we got a new weakling. It's so funny because that's people either go above or below weakling. So it's like this sweet spot. So I'm so happy when we have a supporter. So yeah, Derek, please be in touch and let us know anything you'd like to see on the weekly. And thank you so much for supporting us. You can also support what we're doing in Upturn Table. The join button below this video will let you become a YouTube member. There's YouTube exclusive member content that pretty much mirrors what's on Patreon. Of course, there's no way to do the RSS feed, but you do have the ability to listen to the live stream as audio. But we sweeten the audio for this live stream, put it on the RSS feed for Patreon, and release that every week as well. So you can listen to us on the go. with that feed. And yeah, thank you to everyone who's supporting us through those various means. And that'll do it for this week. We'll be back again next week to do some more. So thank you again, Matt, for joining me, and we'll see you next week.
Matt.
Goodbye.